Welcome to the Senia Happy Hour podcast with your host, Lori Bull. We know you're busy, so we bring you 1 hour's worth of content in under 30 minutes, leaving you time for a true happy hour.
Hello, everyone. Today I speak with Helen Trethewey, who's an experienced inclusion leader with a passion for early identification of children with learning differences. She's worked in education for over 29 years in the UK, Belgium, Hong Kong, Vietnam, and now in Sweden. Helen is dyslexic herself and is a specialist dyslexia teacher and assessor and authors a blog on twice exceptionality. On today's show, Helen and I discuss how executive functions impact students with learning differences, such as ADHD and dyslexia, as well as common misconceptions teachers might have about student performance. I'm always studying and wanting to learn more about executive functioning skills, and I learned quite a bit from Helen today. For instance, did you know that students with ADHD's executive functioning skills are 3 years behind? Yeah, me neither. I'm sure you'll take away a lot from today's podcast as well. So now, on to the show. Well, hello, Helen, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Nice to talk to you this evening.
Well, you have been a Senia presenter at two virtual conferences in the past, or just one?
I originally spoke in Hong Kong. A number of years ago, actually in person. That was my first time with Senia, which was really good.
Right.
And then I was due to speak in the Philippines, which then, due to the pandemic, got completely cancelled.
We all know what happened there, yep.
Yeah, and then I actually think I've done two virtual ones.
Yes, yeah. So you're very well known in the Senia world. And thank you for all you've done. And today we're here to talk about executive functioning skills. Not a new topic for most of us, for sure, but very important to circle back to. And I feel like there's always new information coming in about it, new strategies. And it's just, we just need to know more about it. Dive in, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've just recently moved to Stockholm, and I have a whole school role now. So I actually work with students from 3 all the way through to 18. And it has really made me come back to executive functions, because it's interesting how many students, particularly in secondary school, are so capable. They've got great verbal skills. They notice patterns and connections, but then they just come across as being so disorganized. They don't remember their homework. They don't remember where they're meant to be. They just don't show themselves at the best in lessons. And largely that is due to executive functions.
Yeah. Yeah. And so important. In our role, we often hear frustrated parents or teachers. You know, they call students lazy and ask, why don't they just work harder? Why can't you turn in your work? Why are you so disorganized? How do these executive function difficulties differ from character flaws or choices of students?
It is one of the areas, as I say, the more that I work in international schools and the more I work with more teachers, it's interesting how people still very much view people's performance on to do with effort. You know, if you made more effort, you could listen to instructions better. If you made more effort, you'd remember your homework. If you made more effort, you'd get started. And it's kind of just trying to understand that actually for someone with ADHD, those executive functions are actually delayed and it's not really within their control at all. I was very inspired by a webinar recently with Chris Dendy, and she was talking about the 3 to 5 year delay that students can have in their executive functions. And when you think about that, that's huge. If you've got a 12-year-old student that you're expecting to be fairly independent and fairly mature in the way they're approaching their studies, where in terms of executive function, they're actually more like an 8-year-old, then that's, you know, that's a huge difference. And sometimes our expectations of students is unfair. We think that they have a control over their emotional regulation, for example, or that they're mindful about how their behaviour is affecting other people or even themselves. And yet it isn't actually within their capacity to really understand those things.
That's really interesting. I hadn't heard that 3-year delay. Can you repeat the name of that study or author?
She's an American author. I think she's written quite a lot of books. Okay. I was very lucky to listen to a webinar about her. She's called Chris Dendy.
Okay, great.
She's written a number of books. I think she is a doctor. Some of her children have ADHD. And one of the big points she was making in her webinar was that, you know, a lot of these students do come good eventually, but it can be a long way down the line.
Sure.
I mean, the research generally now is saying that executive functions aren't fully developed until about the age of 25, which is why many students actually struggle when they're at university. And that's a typical development. Then you take a student who maybe has ADHD and you've got that delay. They're probably not kind of coming good, if you like, until they're in their 30s.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is really worth bearing in mind.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I'll put her research in our show notes so people can refer to that when they're listening to this. So, okay, well, let's talk about executive function. You mentioned executive functioning and ADHD. Does the same 3-year kind of thing go for dyslexia as well?
I'm not aware of any research that says that, but it does definitely affect students with dyslexia. And given that a lot of students with dyslexia have ADHD and dyslexia, there's a lot of overlap.
Gotcha.
So it's less certain what the delay is for someone with dyslexia. But if you're including working memory, a lot of the information that's online says that there's 8 executive functions and they include working memory in that. And if you're doing that, then that is huge for someone who is dyslexic, where that is one of their main kind of challenges in life.
Okay.
Has such a knock-on effect. I do find it quite interesting that they say there's 8 executive functions, but if you actually look at the list of them, things like impulse control, emotional control, organization, prioritizing, they're so interlinked. It is just the skills for life. And the thing with the school system is our whole school system is built around the typical development of these skills. So if you think what you expect of an infant, a preschool child, then an elementary school, or I would say an infant child, and the benchmarks we put in education are all based around these executive functions developing normally. And so that's where it's hugely challenging when we're, you know, expecting students in secondary school to be suddenly independent and do their homework in a timely manner. You know, they're given a task to do and they're supposed to just know what to do. And yet many of them haven't got the executive functions to be able to have that level of independence.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting. I had a director of student services reach out to me somewhat recently to ask if there was some sort of continuum of when, or I guess expectations of when students should be able to do these certain executive functioning skills. There's nothing like that would exist, right?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how it's almost like a an intrinsic kind of expectation. You know, like when you're teaching a child who's like 6 and they just blurt out the answer, well, that's perfectly, you know, it's perfectly fine. That's within the normal range. But then you take someone who's, you know, 11 and they're just saying the first answer that comes into their head, that really isn't acceptable. And then that becomes, instead of being a normal behavior, it becomes, you know, that child being difficult or, it becomes that sort of idea of a character flaw, when in fact that person is actually doing, still doing their best. It just isn't age appropriate, as it were.
All right. Well, let's talk about one of the executive functioning skills, task initiation. It's one that I know that, you know, many parents, many teachers, they get frustrated with, because you set a student to work and you follow up about 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, nothing's done. Or there's a long project and, you know, might take weeks for our middle school student, high school student to do an assignment. And then, you know, you follow up about a week, 2 weeks later, and nothing has been done. So can you elaborate a bit more on the genuine difficulty that some students have with task initiation?
Yeah, I mean, task initiation, I would say it's one of the ones where I think people don't talk about it very much. And I would say many teachers and parents don't actually think it is a genuine difficulty. I think they feel that the student is just choosing not to get started. And actually, as you unpick it, it's actually quite complicated, unfortunately, in that there can be a lot of reasons why a student might not get started. For someone with ADHD, you have the brain chemicals, which affect how you approach different tasks. And genuinely, when you are doing something that is very routine or you consider boring, the chemicals for the neurotransmission are not being produced sufficiently. So it's not that you don't want to do the task. You maybe don't want to do it because it's a bit boring, but it isn't so much that you don't want to do it. You actually can't do it. Whereas when you're doing something like a computer game or something that's fun, your brain produces the chemicals that you need and you are energized and you are in the zone. And I think that thing in itself is very puzzling for both parents and teachers. And that's where it feels like it is a choice, because obviously they can't see what's happening inside someone's brain. They can't know that it's almost painful for this student to try and do this routine task that you think is very straightforward. So that's a big factor, I would say, for people with ADHD particularly. But even those with dyslexia or people who find difficulty with task initiation, that it is quite complicated because there's an emotional side to it. So there can be the fear of failure. If you're a student who has had many, many experiences where you've tried to do a task and it hasn't worked out terribly well, you know, there's this sense of, you know, do I even want to start this task and have the teacher not be pleased with me? You know, in a way, it's better not to start it or pretend that I don't want to do it than actually take the risk to get started. And I think that, particularly if there isn't a lot of scaffolding, the fear of the blank page, I genuinely think is quite terrifying. I still remember when I was on a teacher training course and we were asked to write a poem about cats, you know, and it just sounds so simple. You know, it's a poem about cats. I know what a cat is. I know what a poem is. And yet my thoughts were racing. I'm thinking, shall I make it funny? Shall I make it short? Should it be acrostic? What part of the cat should I start with first? Shall I, you know, should I start with the tail or the whiskers? And because all those thoughts are endless, and then you can see other people around you writing, you know, the sense of terror literally does rise. And for me, that was like a real kind of light bulb moment, that for many students, just seeing that blank page and having all these thoughts racing can be quite overwhelming. Oh, and that's why some students literally don't get started, because they actually can't even think of what the first step is to take.
That, yeah, total light bulb moment for me. I had the exact same experience at a PD. We had to write a limerick. And in my whole life, I've been told like poetry is not my thing. You know, growing up in elementary school, teachers are like, not really your thing, Lori. So we had to write a limerick. Gosh, this was about 10 years ago, and I couldn't do it. I just sat there. And then when it came time to turn him in, I was like, yeah, I didn't do it. It was much easier for me not to do it than to fail at writing that limerick. Oh, well, thank you.
I think that whole fear of failure is a really big part. And then there's also for people who've got dyslexia, well, and ADHD, when a teacher's introducing a lesson, the amount of focus that has to go into that of following the instructions, processing new vocabulary, their working memory can really become overloaded, that by the time it's time to actually start the task the teacher wants you to do, you've actually literally drained all your kind of brain energy, if you like. And then you just can't get started. The task just seems too overwhelming, too many steps, too many things to do. So task initiation is definitely actually much more complicated than it initially seems, than people just, they can't be bothered, they're being lazy.
Right.
Or even that they didn't understand it, because there's often a misconception that they didn't understand what to do. And, if you take the poem example, I knew what a poem was, I knew what a cat was, I still couldn't get started.
Right. Okay. Yeah, thanks. So what can educators do? What strategies, interventions can we employ to support students with difficulties? We can focus on working memory, study skills. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things to do. I would say, the very first thing is just actually accepting that the student is doing their best. I think teachers' acceptance that actually what's happening might actually be that student's best, I think is actually can have quite a profound effect. And then, on the practical side, it is about scaffolding. Mm-hmm. Modeling, the teacher actually modeling what they want. So if you're writing a story, a poem, the teacher talks out loud, goes through the thinking process, puts something up on the board, and then that would be the hook, hopefully, for the student to get in. I think we get very caught up in education about being independent and what the student can do independently. And we forget that actually a lot of the learning, even if they are being given some scaffolds, some sentence starters, word lists, the learning is in understanding the process.
Right.
And being knowing how to get to A from A to B. And if they need some help along that, I think that's okay.
Yeah, that zone of proximal development is right in there. Yes, agreed. Okay, well, let's move on to parents. How can we as educators collaborate with parents or other professionals to better support our students to help?
I think the role of the parent is absolutely key in that it really does have to be a partnership with the parents. And so much of developing executive skills is actually to do with the parents. If you think, and this is where it's difficult for students who've got ADHD and dyslexia, because very often their parents have ADHD and dyslexia. So I would argue that a lot of typical students, we feel like they just develop executive functions naturally, but actually what's happening is they're watching their parents do the shopping list or have a diary where they plan out the events. They see their parents pack their bag the night before, make sure everything's in it. And so they're in an environment where these organizational skills, these day-to-day things are kind of being modeled. And that's a huge part of developing the executive functions. Equally, if you've got a parent who is always late and hasn't planned ahead, then it's very likely that you will also follow suit, as it were, without realizing there is a way of not being late and planning your time, more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in terms of teachers and parents, I think the partnership in making children successful in lessons is really key. I'm all for this idea of free teaching. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but the idea that students, rather than doing homework and reviewing what you've done in the lesson, you're kind of getting a heads up on what's coming the next day. And that can make a huge impact in terms of working memory. We know that when you're looking at things that you're familiar with, your working memory is not as challenged. So therefore, if we can get, as educators, if we can get parents to work in partnership with us, and we can post videos on something like Google Classroom as a homework task, and we know the parent will actually support the child and say, look, you've got this video for tomorrow, you do need to watch it. That sort of support can really make a big difference in the classroom.
Yeah, really interesting. I have not heard of the term free teaching. Is that what you call
free teaching? Some people call it okay. Free teaching. Some people call it some people say front loading.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of talk a few years ago about the flipped classroom.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is more bite sized than the flipped classroom. This is just the idea that if you're going to read something in class, or you're going to introduce new vocabulary, that those things could be shared. And particularly when we use a lot of platforms like Google Classroom, those can be easily shared with specific students. But you do then really need the parent to be on board, because otherwise it will just be like other homework tasks that just get ignored and forgotten.
Yeah, that was an example of my hearing needing to be checked. I heard free teaching and then my brain context just went in a different direction. So yeah, got it now. So do you have any success stories or case studies of approaches that have shown promising results?
Well, it's been quite interesting this year because, as I say, it's a new experience for me. I'm working a lot more in secondary school than I have done in the past. And I found it really interesting. I just recently diagnosed a student with dyslexia, where the the parents had suspected it for many, many years. And I said I'd do some study skills sessions with him. And when we started, I was quite surprised, really, that, you know, he didn't know how to make notes. You know, this is a 14-year-old boy who's gone through school and is, you know, he's in the first year of IGCSEs currently. But suddenly he'd started doing quite badly in his studies when things were more intense, more materials, he'd started to do badly, hence the reaching out for the assessment. He'd done quite badly in some assessments. And then I started working with him. And yeah, and he also didn't really know how to memorize things. You know, he would, as someone who's dyslexic, it's quite hard to read, but all he would do was just read the materials to himself and then try and memorize it, which really wasn't working at all. And really, all I did was teach him, one, that verbalizing with your own voice makes a huge difference to your memory. And you just have to teach something, even if you teach the cat, you know, what you learned in physics that day, or you can make videos of yourself if you feel uncomfortable talking to yourself. But just the act of verbalizing what you think you've learned triggers the memory, also helps you. It's like the idea of retrieval practice. You know, you then realize, oh, I didn't really remember that word, and you can check back to your notes. So that was one of the strategies I did with him. And then the other one was to do with word association and with particularly scientific vocabulary, trying to think of something that the word reminded him of to help him understand what it meant. So like something like condense, you know, think of condensed milk that's very thick and, you know, kind of squashed together. And then it's the idea, obviously, of the air particles becoming liquid. But those two, it was very interesting, because those two strategies, literally his marks, he's gone from getting D's to getting B's in 6 months.
Yeah.
And teachers are amazed. And again, I think it is, again, success breeds success. So now that he sees it's working, he's more willing to study. He admits himself he spends more time studying because he can see
results.
That it actually works. The results.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible how just some explicit teaching of these skills can help our students so much. And it's just something so simple like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing for me. I always think, you know, it's not actually rocket science. Some of the strategies that are the most effective are actually the most simple. But sometimes we don't think to tell the student those things. We just assume they know how to memorize things, how to study for an exam. And so many of them don't.
When I do quite a bit of presentations as well on executive functioning, mostly in the middle school, high school, all about the teenage brain and executive functioning. And when I'm listing out the strategies for teachers, sometimes I feel silly. I'm like, everyone knows this, right? Like, I don't know if I should present this because everyone knows it. But, you know, I think as teachers, we're very busy and we get really involved with the curriculum and what we need to teach. And sometimes we forget that we just need to dial it back a bit and specifically teach these skills to the students as we're teaching them the curriculum. So, yeah. It is important for us all to learn these these explicit skills and, you know, review them with our students.
Yeah, I think particularly when they move to secondary school, it's where it kind of falls between the cracks. Mm-hmm. Because when I was talking to like an English teacher about teaching note taking, and they're like, well, that's not really to do with English. Why should we do it? You know,
right.
shouldn't. Or if you're talking about research skills, you know, there's an idea, well, that should be the geography teacher who teaches research skills, because that's really important in their subject. But I think somehow these things kind of slip between the cracks because everyone thinks either they have the skills or that someone else has been teaching them.
Exactly. Okay, so let's talk about one more executive functioning challenge, procrastination, something I'm very good at.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are. I was reading an article by Peg Dawson, who wrote Smart But Scattered, and she talks a lot about just baby steps and trying to get the student to take some responsibility, but having kind of a realistic goal of what they're going to achieve. If you imagine a student who never does their homework or rarely does their homework, to break that cycle, it needs to be something quite small. So she suggests asking the student to say what time they're going to start the homework, where they're going to do it, and then to have some sort of small step that is achievable. So it might be just actually getting their homework out of their bag and putting it on the table at 7 o'clock before dinner. Doesn't necessarily mean that they've got to start the task. And then they do that over a period of time with the idea that once they get over that initial hurdle, that perhaps they will then start to do maybe the first question of the homework. And then over a number of weeks, they might do a few more questions. I thought that was a very interesting strategy.
For sure. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Peg Dawson's book, Smart But Scattered. I use it in a lot of my teaching as well. And did you know that she was a presenter, a keynote presenter at one of our Senia conferences in the past?
No, I didn't know.
Yeah, she came. Yeah,
I just recently started reading.
Yeah, she came to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, when we had it there. I think I can't remember the year, but yeah, it was a great, great conference, and we learned so much from her. So, and what about people that think, well, I'll do it, but I'm just really not in the mood for it right now, or I'm tired and tomorrow I'll be more wide awake and I can start this task.
Yeah, I think it's a misconception. A chap called John Perry, who used to be a professor at Stanford, he wrote an article which was about the idea of your kind of future self. And, you know, we have this idea that if we put off something, then our future self will be more in the mood to do it. And he was just trying to challenge that actually, if you've got something that is quite difficult for you to get started with, quite challenging, the chances are the next day it's still going to be difficult and challenging, and the procrastination is not actually helping the situation. In fact, it could make it more challenging, because then you're up to the wire with a deadline, which could then create even more problems and challenges for you.
Right. Yeah. I know for myself, I do. This is a true struggle for me. And so I create time that are work sprints. And so if I'm really going to struggle with a task, I know it's going to be hard for me. I'll set it aside in my calendar, a big block of time, and I don't check email. I don't do anything during that time and just focus on that. That's one strategy that I use to support that.
Yeah. I mean, so. If I'm procrastinating, I tend to find something that I think I can achieve. I know that's kind of sound like I'm putting off, but if I've got a lot of work to do, I will do a couple of short achievable tasks to make me kind of feel good that I'm doing something. And then that normally gives me like the kind of then positive energy to at least make a start on that thing that I've been putting off. But yeah, I find the idea that, you know, you're going to be more prepared to do something on another day is not really very, very rarely is the case.
Well, and I think it's important, you know, we both have just said we procrastinate. I wonder if our students often feel like teachers or their parents or whoever, they don't have these issues. So I just think it's important for us as adults in their lives to share our own executive functioning challenges with them.
I agree. I think it's so important. As someone who I'm dyslexic and I have ADHD, and so, you know, I'm very open with students about the challenges I have and what I found difficult when I was at school. And I think when teachers can be more honest about their mistakes or more honest about how hard things can be, I think it's really very powerful for students to feel they're, you know, they're not alone and that they can be successful as well, with the right guidance and the right strategies.
Yeah. Well, Helen, thank you so much. I think that's all we have time for today, but I've learned quite a deal from you, and I'm sure our listeners are really going to take a lot from this podcast.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for joining us for today's show. For more information, including how to subscribe and show notes, please head to our website. That's senyainternational.org/podcasts. Until next time, cheers.